Walking down to Denver town, watched the western sun go down. Thought that I would stop a while, switch around my TV dial. Got some free TV. Only price was a little boredom. Well, I'm not sure about my taste, but it seemed that TV land was a waste. I saw 30 westerns, 30 private eyes, 30 doctors operated before my eyes. None of the operations was successful, though. It's hard to operate with so much violence around. Well, every few minutes they'd take a break for a profound message on a stomach ache. They sold cures for dandruff, milk from the farm, perfume for my underarms. I've had enough. I'm sticking to greasy kid stuff. Well, the blood and gore was upon the floor, and I couldn't hardly stand no more. So I walked outside to get some air. A theater owner was standing there, carrying a picket sign. Said pay TV was un-American. He said, I'm against that pay TV. I'd much rather have people pay me. $1 for parking, $2 for the show, $3 for the babysitter, there you go. Get to see a widescreen spectacular. Hercules meets Godzilla. Audience meets nausea. Well, pay TV is fine to see. You get much better quality. Broadway shows, heavyweight fights, first-run movies every night. Viewers of Denver, unite. You have nothing to lose but commercials. Well, people are afraid of something new. They laughed at planes before they flew. You know, you only get just what you buy, so give that pay TV a try. Remember, families that pay together, stay together.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Andrew Basevich from August 9, 2010. Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He discusses the bipartisan business of war-making, the destructive patriotism of Washington power elite, and why military power is useless at affecting positive social change. This is 9 minutes. And then after that, from Living on Earth, on October 1st, 2010, Yellow Dirt, Navajo country provided a significant share of America's Cold War uranium. But when the mining companies walked away, no one told the people not to build houses out of the material left behind. This is also 9 minutes.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Scott Horton, and our next guest on the show is Andrew Basevich, former lieutenant colonel, retired. He's the author of the new book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Previously, he wrote The New American Militarism and The Limits of Power. And he has an article, it's under Tom Engelhardt's name, at antiwar.com, right now called The End of Military History. I forget if there was a question mark on that or not. Welcome to the show, Andrew. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm fine.
I really appreciate you joining us on the show today. So, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. I guess the real bottom line here is the bipartisan nature of the war party and the inability of either side to put an end to this when the power switches back and forth. It seems like we just go on and on and on.
Yes, that you have accurately summarized a core message of the book. The fact that since the end of World War II, a national security consensus really has prevailed, leading to the excessive militarization of U.S. policy. And I think bringing us to where we are today, where war has become a normal condition. The one additional thing I would want to emphasize is that it's not simply that Washington is doing these things to us. Rather, we the people become complicit because it's happening right in front of our noses. And we really don't ask the critical questions about whether or not things like war in Afghanistan now in its ninth year actually makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that's too true, and I think people tend to just go along with the consensus. It seems like if you're not expert in something, you go along with what the experts seem to think about it, I guess, is the way most people look at things, you know? I mean, if you were teaching me how to scuba dive, I wouldn't question you. I don't know. You're the expert, right? That's the attitude. And I think also that people believe, and it's interesting. I've read your work for many years, and you always write from this sort of this point of view of a detached, almost like a narrator in the interests of the nation. And yet, I think that that's what people really believe, right? Is that the people who run the government have the national interest in mind. But I'm of the idea that the people who are really the richest and most powerful in our society aren't patriotic at all. And they don't really care about America at all. They just as soon throw us away and move to China.
Not sure I agree with you. And what I would say is that they actually see themselves as patriotic. George Bush, our last president, genuinely believed, in my view, that in invading Iraq in 2003, he was doing something that was consistent with the interests of the nation. Now, he was wildly wrong on that, and he also was utterly blind to the fact that his convictions, in many respects, derived from a set of other considerations at odds with the well-being of the nation. So, yes, if you're a general, you believe that it makes sense for us to be spending $700 billion on the Pentagon's budget. But, of course, if you're a general, you have an interest in the Pentagon continuing to be able to command those kinds of resources. So convictions and interests blur in ways that make it difficult for people to recognize how utterly irrational or counterproductive some aspects of our policy have become.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Man with a hammer, everything's a nail kind of thing. I remember actually reading a Tom Clancy novel, 12 years ago or something, long ago. That's a long time to me. Where the people from the biggest corporations and the government are this revolving door and whatever, but it's just as completely accepted as, of course, legitimate. These are the best and brightest of us all. So, of course, they run TRW and the Defense Department, et cetera.
I think that we're oversimplifying a little bit, but there's a core truth in what you say. The people who run Wall Street and the people who run Washington share a common worldview, and that common worldview very much informs the way Wall Street and Washington view our military power, its purposes, and the amount that we should be investing in military power.
Mm-hmm. And your purpose in this article, as well as in your recent books, is to explain that, from your view, American military power is really not good for anything in terms of, as far as going around the world in order to gain at the expense of these other people in these wars. If it's good for anything, it's good for defense, and that's about it, right?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, I am not a pacifist. I don't wish to see us disarm. I would like to see us have a strong and effective military. But I am absolutely persuaded that force is useful only in very limited and specific circumstances. The belief that military power can effectively be used to shape the international order, to transform societies like Afghanistan, is a great illusion, and it's an illusion that we can no longer afford to indulge.
Well, you know, I've always thought that you set a really great example, because in the most simple TV narrative, to be anti-war means that you're like Michael Moore or something like that. And then there's Andrew Bacevich, and he's calm and he's patient and he's methodically explaining to you what's good for the American Republic and what's not. It doesn't have to be a liberal or a conservative thing, but you always put it across in a way that I like to believe can appeal to conservatives and nationalists and people who would tend to go along with what the war party says.
Well, I thank you very much for that, and I hope that people do view my writing in that way. But, I mean, I would want to reinforce the point that you just made. I think that the notion that questioning war or being skeptical about military power should qualify as a radical or off-the-wall kind of view is itself, I think, deeply un-American. We have forgotten that we have a very rich history in this country in which patriotic Americans were profoundly skeptical of war and of military institutions. And it's time, I think, for us to recover a certain amount of that skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like it's really a threat to our traditions, isn't it, to have so many people engaged in warfare all the time and then coming home, or even while they're gone, their families breaking up and people being unfaithful, and then they come home and they're cops and they abuse people on the side of the road, and you have more and more, racism because people who started out nice kids come back to testing the Hajis as they've been trained to do while they're in the war. This is really polluting who we are here while we're waging these wars over there. Never mind all the violations of our Bill of Rights that goes along and all the rest of that.
No, I think one of the really troubling results of this perpetual war in which we find ourselves involved is that our soldiers have to deal with the consequences. And I think increasingly we're beginning to appreciate this even in reports that we see in the mainstream media, whether you're talking about the prevalence of PTSD, whether you're talking about the epidemic, really, of prescription drugs being used by American soldiers to deal with anxiety, depression, other problems resulting from their combat deployments. We're creating a substantial community of our fellow citizens who are being seriously damaged as a consequence of their participation in war, and that very much demands our attention. It's not something that we can simply sweep under the table by saying, I support the troops, hurrah.
All right, everybody, that is Andrew Basevich. He's the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, which...
Of course, this means war!
It's Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman. Judy Pasternak, a former investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, has written an epic story about U.S. efforts to obtain uranium during the Cold War. Her book, Yellow Dirt, chronicles how mining companies walked away, leaving radioactive ore and tailings behind. And 60 years later, Americans in the Southwest were still being exposed. Judy Pasternak spoke with Living on Earth's Steve Curwood.
You begin your story in Indian country in Arizona in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and you found that some Navajo suspected that they might have some special rocks that outsiders coveted. What did they notice?
They noticed these yellow stripes in the rock, powdery yellow stripe. And really, the first people who settled this one valley, that's the central setting for my book, thought that this was gold.
So this is an area that white people call Cane Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Where people had noticed, the Navajo noticed these yellow rocks. And one of your main characters in this story of Yellow Dirt tells his children never, ever tell any of the white men about these rocks. But I guess temptation eventually overtakes one of them.
Yeah, his son, in fact, his favorite son. And that was well before atomic bombs were being developed. But later, during World War II, one of the Indian traders put some rocks, some samples out on his counter, and he told the son, who was a customer, that this could be worth a lot of money.
And the son immediately goes out and...
Yeah. So then he gathered up some of these rocks that were on the mesa and brought them in.
And it turns out this isn't just any old uranium deposit, Judy, but this is the mother lode of powerful uranium, very rich uranium. What, hundreds of mines are blasted and tunneled across the land as a consequence of this?
Yeah, the Navajo reservation as a whole really has world-class deposits of uranium. And the mesa that rose above Cane Valley was the hottest, richest, most productive uranium mine on Navajo land.
We know a fair amount about the miners, the health effects on them. But your book also documents, I think the first time I've read this, maybe it's another material, about the broad range of suffering that the whole Navajo community suffered as a function of radioactive exposure. Tell us about the watering holes that were left from the surface mining, for example.
There were huge open pit uranium mines in the western part of the reservation because the deposit was so shallow they could just blast it right out of the ground. When the mining companies left, according to their contracts, they were supposed to return the land in as good condition as received, but nobody asked them to fill in these pits. And what happened was they collected rain. And these pits, some of them were half a mile long. And they looked like lakes in the desert. They looked like oases. So shepherds who were coming by were actually pretty grateful for their presence because all of a sudden here was a water supply in the desert. And so they would drink. They would water their herds there and they would drink themselves.
And in Navajo culture, the shepherds are often women, yes?
That's right. And some of those women were pregnant.
What happened to them?
There is a correlation between women who drank contaminated water while they were pregnant and a syndrome that's known as Navajo neuropathy. Children who have this, generally the average age of death is 10. Some lived into their 30s. They had fused, stiffened fingers and toes that were kind of like claws. Many of them had liver damage, and also they had problems with the nerves in their corneas, so it was hard for them to see.
The average age of death was 10?
That's right.
And then abruptly in the late 1960s, the Cold War is over. The government has enough uranium, thank you. Basically, the mines close up. And this is so damning. The government, which is the legal guardian of the tribe, just allows these mining companies to walk away.
Yeah, that's correct. And the mines themselves, the portals were left open. Anybody could wander in. There were great piles of waste rock around. And there were these large hills or small mountains of sandy waste, radioactive waste.
I imagine kids played in this stuff then.
That's correct. And they predicted that kids might play on them. And indeed they did. They used to dig caves in them in the summertime. And then in the winter, there were these, they were a wonderful attraction. You know, it was the only place around to go sledding. The way Navajos lived their lives gave them a much greater exposure than people in a town or city would have. They also used the ore because they were very practical and also very poor. They used the ore, which had been very nicely squared off by the blasting, to build foundations for their houses and fireplaces and bread ovens. They used the sandy leftovers from the four processing mills that were on the reservation to mix cement, and it got a reputation for making really nice, smooth cement. So they used it for floors that they slept directly on and for stucco walls. So they brought this stuff into their daily lives, into their homes.
So Navajo are making homes out of uranium and other related, other radioactive materials.
Yeah. Yeah, in essence, they were living in another mine.
Meanwhile, of course, the largely white uranium towns in Colorado, like Grand Junction, are getting cleaned up.
Right. And a lot of that was a matter of having political clout. Grand Junction had a processing mill in town. And when it was realized that people had been coming in and taking some of the sand to use in construction, the federal government spent $250 million taking the contaminated stuff out of thousands of homes there. They went house to house where they dug up contaminated soil. They would replace the trees and the grass. But at the same time, Navajos were actually using the material to put it into their homes.
Your series of articles runs in the Los Angeles Times, what, in 2006? And some wheels began to turn after that. Tell us what happened.
One thing that happened was that Congressman Henry Waxman read the series and he thought that actually that other members of Congress who had Navajo constituents might do something, but nothing much happened. And part of that is there isn't anybody who kind of represents the whole reservation. And so Waxman decided after a while that he was going to do something about it because he found it embarrassing, the situation.
Now, at this time, Congressman Waxman, who's a Democrat from California, is what, chairing the House Oversight Committee?
Oh, yeah, with the Oversight Committee. And so he basically, his jurisdiction was, as he put it, everything. They had a hearing. For the first time, they brought a number of federal agencies to account together. It was hard to point fingers when the others were there. But he did something that was pretty unusual. He also followed up. After the hearing, he has since continued to bring these people together for meetings, including the Navajo tribe there and the various agencies. And he has pushed them to come up with a 5-year multi-agency cleanup plan, which probably won't do the whole job, but getting some momentum going. It's now in year 2.
I believe in your book you say that Navajo EPA official, he had, what, a Geiger counter at this congressional hearing?
Yeah, he brought the soil in, and they had had to inform the Capitol Police ahead of time, and he ran a Geiger counter over this container of material, and the noise of the clicks just filled the room. The police immediately took it and got it out of there. Time to go.
Time to go. And so after Congressman Waxman's hearings and your story, I gather slowly some of these radioactive homes where there's, what now, a fourth generation of Navajos sleeping in, They're getting cleaned up?
Yeah. I had the pleasure last fall of tagging along with someone from the U.S. EPA and the Navajo EPA as they were giving out keys to new safe homes to people whose contaminated houses had been knocked down. And they were pretty shocked people to find that, you know, something was actually happening after all this time. It was bittersweet, though, because people had died in the meantime.
Judy, thanks for taking the time with me today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Living on Earth, Steve Curwood and author Judy Pasternak. Her new book is Yellow Dirt, an American story of a poisoned land and a people betrayed.
Dad always used to say the only causes worth fighting for were the lost causes.
Again, where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
That's all, folks.